Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's a number to call, 1-800-462-7413. Along with your call, some topics to talk over. Zorba, what are they?
Yes, laughter. Faking laughter, real laughter. Can we tell the difference? What does that mean to us from an evolutionary point of view?
Ha, 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 ha.
Yeah, yeah.
Fake, what else?
Faker. And one in four teens do not meet the screen time guidelines. In other words, watching television, looking at the computer. Are our kids sitting less and doing less? We'll talk about that.
And our recipe?
Grilled eggplant parmesan sandwiches. Do you like eggplant parmesan?
No.
I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. It's one of my favorite dishes. But these are eggplant parmesan sandwiches. For anyone who loves eggplant, this recipe is for you. Even Tofu Tom might like it.
I'm not sure as an adult if I've ever tried eggplant.
Wait a second.
I might actually like it.
Time out. You're not sure as an adult if you ever tried eggplant?
Yeah.
You mean your mother fed you eggplant
as a child? No. I mean, at one time in my hard-to-describe youth, I may have tried it and not liked it.
You haven't eaten eggplant in years?
In a long time, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I might like it.
It's delicious.
I'll try it sometime.
It's delicious.
Yeah. And let's get to the phones.
Sounds great.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Listener with us now in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hi.
Aloha, Zorba, Tom. How are you guys doing?
Fine. Are you in Hawaii or Wisconsin Rapids?
Wisconsin Rapids, but I'm trying to change up the stereotype instead of the hey there, I'm going for aloha.
Go for it. How can we help?
All right. Hey, great. I'm so excited to be on the show. I've been goldsmithing since I was 16. I'm currently about 39.9 years old, and I've developed an ache in my right ankle. Now, as a goldsmith, you press on a foot pedal repetitively every day.
So
what is goldsmithing? What is that?
I'm a second-generation goldsmith in my family, which means I set diamonds. I can make jewelry, size jewelry, fix things. I guess there's not a lot of goldsmiths out there anymore, but there's three in my family. So.
And you use your feet and ankles in that somehow or other?
Yeah, there's a flex shaft is a tool that has like a quarter horsepower small engine that is attached to a shaft that you have a handpiece, kind of like what the dentists use, and that you grind on the gold in different manners with different abrasive material, and you press on it with your my right foot to make the speeds and RPMs change.
Got it.
For grinding.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if it's possible to develop a symptom similar to carpal tunnel in your ankle like that you can get in your wrist is my question.
That's very interesting. I mean, people always ask me, what interesting questions have you had? And I've never thought about the equivalent of carpal tunnel for the foot.
Now, the
thing about carpal tunnel is it's a very specific nerve that goes through a very small number of bones, a bunch of bones that are in the wrist called the carpal bones, and they have a tunnel. It's a very the bones can impinge on it from repetitive motion because basically you're putting pressure on the ligaments around the nerves, around the bone, and then that pushes on the nerves. So we don't have that, but we do have a tarsal tunnel. In other words, the tarsal bones, not the carpal bones, but the tarsal bones that are in our ankle that help us move around our ankle and go through different, you know, the ankle is not a simple joint that goes forward and backward, we'll say like the knee, but it goes, you know, it goes inward and outward. There also is a tarsal tunnel, and there are nerves that go through there that, that feed the foot. So thinking outside the box or outside the tunnel, the answer is yes, I'm sure you can have tarsal tunnel syndrome. And, you know, people ask me, do I have Google that I'm looking at on the show? And the answer is no, I don't. But the reality is in the back of my brain, I do remember there is a tarsal tunnel syndrome. And if not, you may have it anyway because of repetitive motion.
So given that, what could he do?
Maybe? Well, let's talk about it. So there are a couple of things that we do for carpal tunnel that may work for tarsal tunnel. So for carpal tunnel, often it's repetitive motion. People are often sitting at their computer, screen time, and we tell them to put a little gel pad underneath so that they're resting their wrist on the gel pad. Also, another thing we do for carpal tunnel is we change the keyboard. There are ergonomic keyboards that are different. Sometimes when people are at a standing desk, that'll make a difference. So moving that now to the ankle, one of the things you may do is change the angle at which you're pushing back and forth on the pedal that you're using. In other words, either elevate the elevate it slightly, put the whole thing in a little box so that you've got a slightly different angle on it, or put a little heel pad you know, underneath it so that your foot is slightly raised, so that when you're doing the repetitive motion of going back and forth with the ankle, you're going to change it. You're not going to do it exactly the same way each time. Sometimes you'll put a pad underneath. Sometimes you won't put a pad underneath. I have found that extremely useful for me for back pain. I have a stool in front of my computer underneath my desk, and I'll put my foot on my stool, relaxes my back. I'll take the foot off the stool, and my back is in a different position. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's a great idea to just elevate those foot pedals a little bit.
So right, that, and when you elevate it, you may find I want to elevate it now, and an hour later you may say you may take it off, and you don't want to elevate it because repetitive motion is doing the same thing in the same way over and over and over
again. Now, I've had ankle problems, and I've used standing on a soft pad in order to strengthen the ankle.
Excellent,
and
excellent.
I think good maybe point. That would
good
work
point.
For him.
Well, good point. Actually, Tom brings up a very good point. Have you gone to a physical therapist?
I went for some micro tears in my foot from working in my slippers too much.
You know, looking at that, sometimes one visit with a physical therapist or a trainer that looks at how you're actually doing something can make a huge difference in what actually goes on. So I would recommend that. And I want to give you an example for me. I went to PT when I fractured my ankle, and then I've got a trainer. I get a trainer, a different trainer every year or two at the university, and I love them because they're all kind of – everyone looks at me a little differently. And my trainer showed me – my right shoulder comes out – how my right I use my right shoulder differently than my left shoulder, gave me a couple of exercises. All of a sudden, the shoulder pain went away. Mm. And I've had this pain on and off for about 20 years. Just someone looking at the way I stood with my shoulders saw something that I never saw. So that would be another recommendation. Have somebody look at what you're doing. Physical therapist or trainer, they may give you some good exercises. But try that pad and let us know. Let us know if that works.
I will. Thanks a lot. I appreciate everything. And Tom, it's beautiful here, but it's not as beautiful as Zorba.
Thanks
he
a lot.
He must have seen a
Thanks
different a picture hey, than I'm looking
hey,
at. Right?
Come on.
1-800-462-7413. Toll free. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, to our first topic and the question, why is laughter so hard to fake?
Yeah, how's it? And you know when somebody isn't laughing, don't you?
Right. That like was that. A fake. That's that was right. pretty good.
Wasn't yeah, it? That was pretty good. Yeah. But it was fake because it also, well, that sounds good. Okay. Yeah. That sounds pretty normal. Yeah. But it's not in response to something I've said or something you've seen, right? Yeah. In other words, if you just laugh out of the blue, then you're either, you know, you're listening to voices inside yourself and something is wrong. And I've seen that with patients who are schizophrenic. Yeah. All of a sudden, they'll be sitting there. Yeah. I remember on my psych rotation, and they'll start laughing for no reason at all. They're not watching anything or doing anything. And that in itself is very unusual.
Well, and I'm a radio professional, so I'm pretty good at faking stuff.
Right? Yes, because you're a radio professional. But you can't fake it to people who you know, right? Doesn't Monica know if you're not laughing, if you're faking a laughter?
Laugh so seldom.
Yeah, right. That's exactly it. Well, this is a particular study that showed that at normal speeds, people could tell about 2/3 of the time if it was a fake or a real laugh because they were looking at people. When they sped it up, they couldn't find it out. When they made it slower, they really, you know, they couldn't find it out necessarily as much. When it was slowed down, real laughter was indistinguishable from sort of, you know, an animal sound. They couldn't tell real from fake laughter. But at normal speed, you and I, 2/3 of the time, people can tell if it's fake. Hmm. The theory is there's something hardwired in us to tell if it's real laughter or fake laughter. I think that makes sense from an evolutionary point of view. We have a physical evolution and we have cultural evolution.
Yeah.
Physical evolution, it's gone on. The most important thing was 500 generations ago, our ability to digest milk. But cultural evolution allows us to get together and work on projects and then improve projects. And laughter is important. It binds us together.
I don't know how they could do that study. I mean, how?
Well, they put people in front of screens, and then they looked at people laughing, and they said, is this real or is this fake? That's the way they did it.
Yeah, but how did they confirm whether it was real?
Well, these are people who were actually laughing in a real way. In other words, like, you know, they told jokes to somebody, and they were laughing, and they said, okay, laugh. Right now, your smile. That's right.
I'm laughing because I think it's a silly study.
There was a fake laugh. They're not laughing now.
They told them a joke and they laughed and they knew that was real.
Well, no. They put them in front. You know, this is not a fake study. This is not a fake. See, no, that was a real laugh. That was not a fake laugh.
Okay. 800-462-7.
You know what? I'm done. I am taking this. I am walking out of here.
No.
This is
stick
it.
Stick around.
We're not doing the rest of the show.
We're just getting going.
You know what?
Listeners to help
you. I'm
here.
Done.
1-800-462-7413.
Here it is. I try to improve the laugh of people. What do I get? Fakeness.
1-800-462-7413. Now, seriously, Zorba, we welcome a caller in Chicago, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So the background is I picked up my son from school. He's a middle schooler. And this was earlier this spring. And he got in the car and he said, I think I'm allergic to carrots. And I had him share with me his symptoms. And he said he had an itchy throat and then his face itched as well. So inside the throat and then on his face, he said he gets a tightening in his chest, and it sort of makes him hard to breathe. And of course, I've been packing carrots in his lunch for years now. So of course, the mother guilt just, you know, jumped out at me. And so I guess my question is, how severe is a carrot allergy? I've never even heard of this. And might he outgrow it? And is there anything tied to cooked or raw carrots, like foods that kids have allergies to? Does it depend on, like, how they're prepared to determine the severity?
Uh-huh. I have never heard of a carrot allergy. Hmm. Never. I mean, it's interesting.
But the description sounds like an allergic reaction.
Sounds like some kind of a reaction to that. So have you given him cooked carrots, tried different kinds of carrots?
Well, the fact that he said it made it hard to breathe, I decided I really wouldn't force the issue when he said he eats carrots and it's hard to breathe.
How old is he?
He's 14.
Oh, he's 14. Okay. So he said, it's hard to breathe, Mom, now that I take the carrot. So first of all, a true honest-to-goodness allergy, it will often be with hives. You'll have difficulty breathing. You'll swell up. You know, it's a full-body reaction. It's not just, you know, it's a full-body reaction. So I kind of question, you know, I he's got some kind of symptoms, but I question whether or not, you know, this is an allergic reaction or not. So let's say we're actually trying to see if it is an allergic reaction. Mm-hmm. So number one, you can go to an allergist, easy way to tell. And what they do is they'll give him different foods in the office. They'll be there with adrenaline in the office. An EpiPen is an instant way to get adrenaline at home. They'll give him the food and see whether or not he develops an allergic reaction. The other issue is it may have been that there was something on the carrot that was giving him an allergy. You know, there may have been a contaminant, for you will. It may not have been washed correctly. There may have been something else within the package that was actually causing this reaction. Or, alternatively, people just have reactions that have nothing to do with what they eat. Or take. So let me give an example for that. For many, many years, I've done pharmaceutical research, and we have often had people who say, I've got a rash. It's a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. They may be on a placebo, and they may be on the actual drug. Mm-hmm. And so we will take them off the drug, and we will often wait for a week or two, and then we will often restart the drug to see if they have an allergy in our office with adrenaline standing by. And 95% of the time, the rash or the shortness of breath does not go away. Does not come back, rather. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, it doesn't come back, and we don't know what actually occurred with that. So I would question whether or not he has a true allergy, and I think he should get tested.
Thank you so much for the call. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's take an email question from Catherine of Random Lake, Wisconsin. She writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I recently decided I didn't want to be another overweight American, so I started counting calories and wearing my pedometer. Since then, I have stayed below 1,500 calories per day, and I started getting my 10,000 steps in. To date, I have lost 26 pounds.
Wow. Awesome.
I plan to always stay below 2,000 calories per day, but am now concerned that I will put some of those pounds back if I increase my calorie consumption from below 1,500 to below 2,000 per day. Is there a right way to add those calories back in so they don't stick around? Thank you for your perfect advice.
Perfect advice. You know, we are incredibly efficient machines, biological machines. Mm-hmm. And when we fast or we go below our caloric intake that what we need, we tend to become actually much more efficient. And the problem is, as soon as we add any calories back, we tend to add the pounds back. And it may be for this person that they only need below 1,500 calories in order to maintain their weight, they may not need 2,000 calories a day for what they're doing. So if I wanted to keep the weight off, I would be incredibly careful. I would tend to stay below that and see what happens. And I would stay below that. I would stay just what she is doing for probably about 6 months to a year before I would add anything back. Because if you add 200 calories back, you might be adding 5 pounds back to your frame.
That's not what she wants to hear.
No, it is not. It is not.
Has a question been weighing on you? Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our recipe is coming up. That's next. We have some more of your calls, of course. Looking forward to those. Another topic to talk over in our Medical Mythbuster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. Callers waiting, an open line for you too. Before our next call, Zorba, our recipe, this one for grilled eggplant parmesan sandwiches.
You know, good eggplant parmesan is delicious. Bad eggplant parmesan is kind of soggy, and it's one of my favorite dishes. I make eggplant parmesan all the time, and this recipe is kind of a variation of what I ordinarily do. I love eggplant parmesan. Have I said I like eggplant parmesan?
I think so.
Anyway, grilled eggplant parmesan sandwiches.
Okay.
So start out with one eggplant cut into 12 1/4 inch rounds.
One eggplant cut into 12
yeah,
and a basically, quarter inch
Yeah,
long.
Basically
That's
what you're doing.
Specific.
Yeah, what you're doing is you're taking the eggplant, you wash it off, you keep the skin on, and you cut it into slices that are about a quarter inch.
Yeah.
You may not get 12. It depends on the size of the eggplant.
Yeah.
But basically, you cut it into quarter inch rounds. If they're too thick, it's not good, and if they're too thin. So
got
it's got to be – that is critical. Some olive oil cooking spray.
Olive oil cooking spray.
Quarter of a teaspoon of salt. Use kosher salt.
Quarter little tea salt.
3 tablespoonfuls of shredded Parmesan cheese.
3 big tea shredded Parmesan cheese.
1/2 cup of shredded mozzarella.
1/2 cup of shredded mozzarella.
4 pieces of focaccia bread, you know, or rustic Italian bread.
Yeah, 4 pieces of bread.
Now, do not use Wonder Bread. I know you're shocked, but do not use Wonder Bread.
Okay.
Anyway, getting back to the recipe, 2 teaspoons of extra virgin olive oil.
2 little tea extra virgin olive
five ounces of baby spinach.
5 ounces of baby spinach.
That was real laughter. That was not, fake laughter.
I got
not
it.
Fake laughter. 1 cup of crushed tomatoes. I will use crushed tomatoes out of a can because, frankly, they are delicious. And you may want to use fire-roasted crushed
tomatoes. Yeah, they are good, aren't they?
Yeah,
that's
they're
about
very
the
good.
Only thing in a can.
They
that
do.
And baked beans in a can.
Oh, I like baked beans out of a can.
Yeah.
Did you ever make baked beans?
Sure.
Yeah, right.
every week or two. Yeah, absolutely.
3 tablespoons of fresh chopped basil.
3 big tea fresh chopped basil.
You know, we need a recipe for baked beans. I've had homemade baked beans, and they're really good, but I've never made them.
Yeah.
Okay, preheat the grill to medium high. Okay, place eggplant rounds on a baking sheet. Sprinkle with a little kosher salt.
Mm-hmm.
Coat both sides with cooking spray. So you spray the cooking spray on the outside. Very important because they've got to be sprayed. And then put them, combine them with the Parmesan and mozzarella in a small bowl and brush. And that's what you do. So they've got a little cooking oil, a little salt, and then the Parmesan and the mozzarella is going to stick to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now take the focaccia or Italian bread and brush it with the olive oil. So the bread will have the olive oil before. Now, spinach. Take spinach in a large microwave safe bowl, cover with plastic wrap, punch a couple of holes in it, microwave it until it's wilted 2 to 3 minutes. Okay, so the spinach is now wilted.
Mm-hmm.
You could use frozen spinach, but if you're going to use frozen spinach, you've got to make sure you get the water out of it, and you do that by squeezing it really hard with some paper towels. Then combine it with tomatoes and basil. With tomatoes and basil in a small microwave safe bowl, cover and microwave it for another minute or two. So you've got this spinach, tomato, basil combination. Place all the ingredients on a baking sheet. Bring it outside to the grill. Okay, you're walking outside to the grill. Grill the eggplant slices until they're brown for 2 to 3 minutes on both sides. That's actually very simple. Grill the bread until it's toasted, about 1 minute on each side. And then you return the eggplant to the baking sheet and reduce the grilling heat to medium, and then place 1 eggplant round on the top of 1 eggplant slice, put a tablespoon of the tomato and spinach and wilted meadow, put it on top of it, sprinkle it with some remaining basil on top, put it together, and you've got a sandwich.
Yeah.
It's a unique way of eating eggplant. And if you like eggplant like I do, this is good. And eggplant parmesan sometimes can be greasy because we use too much butter. In this case, you're not using it, you're using spray.
Yeah. And I can find out these ingredients and how to put this together on my computer.
Oh, I bet you can. Your computer, your smartphone. And you can do that by going to Facebook and finding it through Facebook, or even better, ZorbaPastor.org. You can look at this recipe, other recipes. You can look at Tom. You can look at me. It's great. Come to our website at ZorbaPastor.org, or remember, we are all over Facebook.
I just got a new TV, and it's a smart one, so I could find this on my TV.
Absolutely, Tom. You can find it on your monitor.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Back to the phones we go now, Zorba. And a listener with us in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, basically, my lower back is a mess. I've got severe arthritis and degenerated discs in 5 vertebrae in my lower back, and that's producing pain in my left hip and my left femur. Basically, what I like to learn is some things I can do to minimize the further wear and tear on the discs.
Mm-hmm.
Things like maybe lifestyle and diet and maybe physical therapy.
Oh, sure.
That sort of thing.
Sure. Well, you actually hit the major points, lifestyle, diet, and physical therapy. So let's look at your – what's your height? What's your weight?
I'm 5'8", 150.
150. Okay. So you're at a good weight. You know, you're at a good weight. So that's a very important thing. If you're overweight, the first thing we recommend is trying to lose 5 or 10 pounds because that can often help on the frame with that. Next step, you taking anti-inflammatories at all? You know, naproxen or ibuprofen?
No, I'm on a blood pressure medication, so mm-hmm. I'm avoiding ibuprofen. I take an aspirin occasionally. That's uh-huh. about it.
Uh-huh. So you're avoiding ibuprofen because you're worried about the interaction with your blood pressure medicine?
Yes.
Okay. A lot of people can tolerate blood pressure medication and ibuprofen or naproxen, just to let you know. One way to find out whether or not it's going to interact or make a difference is you either get an automatic blood pressure cuff, check it at home, take two naproxen twice a day over the counter. I like naproxen better because it's an every 12-hour drug. See what it does for your pain. See if it affects your blood pressure at all. For some people, it has no effect. For other people, it may interact with their blood pressure pills, so they have to alter their blood pressure pill slightly. But I just want to mention that because if you have less pain, you can often do more exercise. What are you doing for exercise for your back?
Yes, calisthenics in the morning and in the afternoon and walking 3 miles every morning.
Sounds like you're doing quite a bit. Stretching exercises in there with your calisthenics?
Well, problem is I haven't been able to do a thing over the past couple of weeks. The pain has gotten so bad.
Has gotten so bad. Okay. When you sit in a chair, what do you do to make sure you don't have as much pain?
Well, I sit very slowly, for one thing,
to get
adjusted, and then try to lean back gradually.
Mm-hmm. So what I would do prior to that is I would try to reduce the pain. I might use arthritis strength Tylenol generic. And what you do is you take one tablet 3 times a day. It will not interact with your blood pressure pills. After 1 or 2 days, if it didn't get better, I would take 2 tablets 3 times a day. Again, that's the arthritis strength. It's larger. And I would take 2 tablets 3 times a day, 1 to 2. If that didn't work, I'd go to naproxen, check my blood pressure to see what it is, see if you can reduce the pain pharmacologically before you have the radiofrequency ablation. If so, then I would go to stretching exercises either from a trainer or a physical therapist. Because the more stretching you do before the ablation, the better off you're going to be after the actual, you know, after the actual procedure.
Great.
I hope that helps. You're at the right weight. You've got the right attitude. That's going to make a big difference over time.
Thank you so much.
Oh, sure. You're welcome.
Appreciate
Thanks for
call.
Your call.
Thank you very much. 1-800-462-7413, toll free. And Zorba in Dayton, Ohio, callers with us now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
I'm actually calling on behalf of my mother. She's 57, and she has an autoimmune disorder called dermatomyositis.
Dermatomyositis?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Okay.
Sorry for the mispronunciation.
Uh-huh. Sure.
It actually causes calcinosis in her, where she gets calcium deposits. And it's mainly in her hands and her feet.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually see it protruding off of her fingers, large. It looks like hard rocks. It's calcium. And she's been to several different specialists, and has had many surgeries on her fingers to get the calcium deposits out. However, she's not on any sort of medication. She's never been prescribed any sort of treatment. And I didn't know if there's any cures or treatments that can prevent this disease from progressing any further, or maybe she's in a lot of pain from those calcium deposits.
Sure, sure, of course. Of course, you know, we can all just imagine what the pain would be like to have calcium placed in places that it really shouldn't be placed. Now, dermatomyositis, if that's, you know, indeed what she has, and it sounds like, is an autoimmune disease where the body basically is developing antibodies and inflammation against itself. Isn't she seeing a rheumatologist at all?
Yes. She has.
Mm-hmm.
she went up actually to the Cleveland Clinic here in Ohio and had many doctors take a look at her, but all of them had said they had never seen it this bad before. She's never had a full body scan, but from what doctors have said, they believe it's throughout her body. She's had her foot and her hands and places where they knew it was that she's had a scan there.
Right.
But they believe it's probably all throughout her body.
So the Cleveland Clinic, which as we all know is one of the top clinics in the U.S., they did not put her on any treatment at all?
No.
Mm-hmm. She obviously, you know, when you go to a specialty clinic like that, they have people who really deal with, you know, the difficult problems that we normal physicians often don't see. Mm-hmm. We're looking at that. So, you know, I take it for granted that to some extent they had to see a rheumatologist there who didn't have an answer for what that is. And the real question is, who is the world's authority on dermatomyositis? I mean, that's kind of the issue that's there. I have a couple of suggestions. Mm-hmm. So first of all, there is no one clinic or one doctor that has a monopoly on information for unusual diseases. So even though you've gone to the Cleveland Clinic, which is a great institution, I wouldn't stop there. If it were my mom, I'd say, well, you don't have the answer, Cleveland Clinic, but I'm going to find the world's authority on dermatomyositis. They might be in New York, they might be at the Mayo Clinic, they might be in California, and I'm going to find that person. How do I find the world's authority on dermatomyositis is somewhat difficult. So you live in Dayton, Ohio. Is there a university clinic in Dayton?
Not in Dayton. There's the Ohio State Medical Clinic in Columbus, which is about an hour away, so that's not too far.
Okay. So what I would do is I would call, because you're in Ohio, I would call up, like you said, I would call up the university in Columbus. I would get a hold of their rheumatology department. I would get a hold of the head of rheumatology. I would find out who that is. I'd do it initially on the phone. And then what I would do is I would say, I've gone to the Cleveland Clinic with my mother and I haven't gotten any results for her. I want to know who might be a world's authority on dermatomyositis. Can you make any recommendations? Because what you want to do is go to an expert nearby who may know. Now, maybe somebody at, you know, there, and they might say, come bring your mother in. We'd like to look at the records and do it. You want to have a look from various places. And this is a case where university clinics and specialty clinics come in. And they might say, bring your mother in. We'd like to look at her and we'll give you some ideas. That's one way I would go. Close to home, major university. The second way I would go is I would look towards alternative cures. I would look towards naturopaths, acupuncturists, to see whether or not they would have anything to offer my mother. Autoimmune diseases are not well understood. We describe them, but we really don't understand why they're happening. And I would use the two-prong approach. Okay.
Okay.
Good
well,
luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
Thank you so much for the call. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Now, before the break, Zorba, you'll have to put on your pilot wing pin for another edition of Traveling Tips from Zorba. Today's question comes to
us. Wait a minute. I don't know where I have a pin like that. You mean like they.
You don't have
like
a pilot wing pin?
No, I should get one. I need it. I've never had a, like they have on the airlines with the two little wings on
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've never had a pilot wing pin. No one has ever sent me, hint, hint,
we have a pilot. We have a pilot listening pin. Who will send you a
yes,
pilot
oh,
wing
that would
pin.
Be one. I need one.
And you
I
will wear it.
I promise I might even wear it when I fly.
Today's question comes to us from Jessica, who is listening in Japan, regarding the safety of flying while pregnant. She writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I am 4 months pregnant and planning a trip overseas in another 2 months, assuming I still get the okay from my doctor at that time. I will be flying from Japan to Oklahoma and back, a 24-hour travel in total each way, with the longest flight time at 13 hours. I am quite healthy and fit and a very low-risk pregnancy. Will I be putting myself or my baby in any danger by flying? And are there any things I can do to keep us both as healthy as possible during the flight? I have always loved your show. Thank you for your help.
Well, first of all, before you fly, it's always important to recheck with your doc. I mean, that's number one. And the reason is you want to see how the pregnancy is. It's a viable pregnancy, and you want to make sure that there are no complications. Now, individual doctors then say, I don't want you to fly after a certain number of months. So, for instance, most doctors would say, do not fly in your eighth month. Why? Well, you're more likely to deliver in the ninth month, and you don't want to be all of a sudden. So talking to your doctor, looking at that is important. But on the airplane, if your doctor says, okay, the issue is hydration and walking around. When you're pregnant, you're at a higher risk for thrombophlebitis, you know, which is inflammation of the vein that can lead to blood clots. Mm-hmm. So it's often important to wear support stockings, TEDS stockings, we call them, compression stockings. And it's also important to get up every hour or two and walk around the airplane, which means the seat you want is not the one next to the window, because you're going to have to go past two people.
Right.
You're going to want to have an aisle seat. You may also request from the airline that you have a bulkhead seat so you can actually put your legs out. Those are kind of the tips that I would have for flying. Getting checked out before you go, incredibly important, because you want to make sure things are safe for you and the baby.
Mm-hmm. Before you lift off, make sure to check in with Zorba. Just send your travel questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or send it through Facebook.
Another interesting topic to talk over. That's coming next. More of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, there apparently are guidelines for how long teens should sit in front of computers or TVs, and surprise, surprise, most teens aren't obeying those guidelines.
Right, right. So first of all, let's look at the guidelines. They come from the American Academy of Pediatrics. Okay, so first of all, they say children under 2 should get no television time at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm a parent of 4.
Yeah.
Do you think I will follow those guidelines?
Well, do kids under 2 really watch TV?
You know, sometimes you're fixing the meal and they're 6 months old and you put them in front of Sesame
Street. I guess
something
that's going on.
I think it's ridiculous. I think that guideline is ridiculous.
Okay.
Under 2 years of age, they shouldn't be in front of a TV. I understand that, but I remember it'd be fixing dinner and Penny would be somewhere else. And you know, you put the kid in front of the TV and have them watch it.
And your kids, by the way, have done all right.
Yes, our kids have done very well. Thank you.
Right.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think the guideline under 2 is absolutely silly. I think limiting that is a completely different issue. Using the TV as for under 2 years of age, as a babysitter is ridiculous. But now let's look at older kids.
Yeah.
Only 27% of the kids meet the guidelines of these are teenagers 12 to 15, 2 hours or less. That I think is extremely important. In other words, 2/3 of the kids are sitting in front of the TV or the computer for more than 2 hours a day.
Right.
I think that's leading to obesity. I think it's leading to children who do not exercise enough. And I completely agree with that. I think that is a really good guideline.
Yeah. And, of course, TV's been around for a long, long time, and kids have been sitting in front of TVs, and we do have a lot of obesity.
Oh, absolutely. No, exactly. But if you look at it, if they look at TV daily viewing in the interviews, 99% of the kids say they watch TV daily. 99%.
Yeah.
That means they're all watching TV every day.
Right.
91% of the kids say they look at a computer or a smartphone every day. So, I mean, these are huge numbers. Now, these are numbers of most kids. Some kids do not have access to TV. That's very few. And, you know, fewer and fewer kids don't have access to computers. But parents, it's a matter of getting your kids out there and doing something, because the TV and computer is captivating.
Can we put smartphones in a different category? Because kids can be using those things while they're walking around or...
Well, but it's still... But often, yes, you're standing, you're walking around. But a lot of smartphone use is really computerous. Most of the time, the kids are looking at smartphones. They're sitting in front of them, they're texting, and they're not moving. And the fact is, as a teenager, as a young adult, you have to move your body and get off your duff. Because if you don't want to get off your duff, you're at risk for obesity, and that's the issue. And obesity is a lifelong problem we want to avoid. Pull the plug and shut off the screen.
800-462-7413, and a listener now, Zorba in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I'm a really healthy 60-year-old woman, except that I just got my third round of kidney stones and have been put on a very low oxalate diet, and I'm a vegan. So I'm finding it extremely challenging, and a couple of years ago, I really turned my life around and lost 90 pounds and have taken excellent care of myself, and I'm just a little overwhelmed with how to eat.
Yes, I can imagine. First of all, to start out with, there is no evidence that a low oxalate diet will produce less kidney stones.
Oh, that's good news.
Yes, that's good news. I don't think there's any evidence at all. I've never seen any controlled studies that show that a low oxalate diet is going to affect kidney stones. I wish that it would. And you've had several sets of kidney stones. Yeah, I would not do any diet. I've had a kidney stone. I don't follow it. I've looked it up. I've never seen any evidence of a diet. So there's something that does help. It's hydration. So when I first had my kidney stone, I thought, okay, I'm going to have water with me all the time and hydrate. And then I found out I didn't really like it. I mean, I like to drink when I'm thirsty and not drink when I'm not thirsty. Now, there's some studies that show that perhaps some diuretic hydrochlorothiazide may make a difference. I've never been impressed by the data. But I don't think a low oxalate diet did that. Who put you on the diet?
Two different doctors and urologist and my internist. They just handed me this huge list of very high oxalate and moderate oxalate things, and so don't eat any of this. But you know, it eliminated much of my protein choices as a vegan.
Yeah,
so it's been very difficult.
You know, I would venture to say that I have not seen any hard scientific evidence. Now, there may be some hard scientific evidence out there that I haven't seen. But what I'll do is I'll do some research, and I'm going to answer this on our website. Go to zorbapastor.org or go to us on Facebook, and I will pull up some studies on oxalate diets. Now, if it were me, and I had a kidney stone 15 years ago, and I were now saying, this diet doesn't fit with me, I'm a vegan, and it's very, very difficult, I wouldn't go on the diet if I had a kidney stone once every 15 years. I mean, obviously, you've been eating normally, and you got a kidney stone, and whatever you're doing, it's an extremely rare event. You may not get another one. And there are a certain number of people that produce stones. Now, let's assume you're on the diet, and 15 years from now, you're getting a kidney stone. Do you think you'll be going to the same doctors?
No.
No. That's exactly right. And if you did, they might say, oh, sorry, we didn't realize that diet didn't do anything. Sorry you got another stone. I guess the diet didn't work, and you've been on the diet for 15 years that you can't follow.
Right. But you know how it is right after you get one. It's so scary. You're
absolutely
so afraid you're going to get another. So.
Absolutely. And they were trying to say, you know, this is worthwhile. I don't think the evidence is there. But I'll answer it. If you go to our Facebook page, I'll look up the data and see whether or not there is any scientific study worthwhile that shows that this makes a difference.
Well, I will definitely check that out. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you so much for the call. I've been seeing my doc for over 15 years.
Yeah, that's right. You think he'll be there 20 years from now?
I'm going to see him 15, 20 years from now, too.
Real laugh, by the way. That was a real laugh.
800-462-7413. Zorba, time again for our Medical Mythbusters segment. Today's email comes to us from Roger in Red Wing, Minnesota. He writes, hello, Dr. Pastor. A friend of mine in his early 70s is living with type 2 diabetes. Occasionally, he likes to join the rest of us in a cocktail. He's been told rye whiskey, due to the rye used in the distillation process, contains no sugar or carbohydrates, and so he drinks that with diet soda. I've told my friend that all hard liquors, whiskey, gin, vodka, etc., contain no sugar or carbohydrates. Is there something special about rye whiskey, or is this just another medical myth? Thanks. My wife and I enjoy your show very much.
It's a medical myth. It's definitely a myth. There's no doubt about it. Alcohol is calories. You know, I don't care if you have it in beer, you have it in vodka, you have it in rye, you have it in whiskey, it's calories. A calorie means your body is going to digest it. Your body will digest it, in this case, into basically sugar. Yep. And will affect your diabetes. So how much does it affect it? Well, you know, a shot is not a lot of, you know, it's not a lot of sugar or carbohydrate. It is an alcohol, but the reality is you do digest it. It's not, you know, it's not free of calories, and anything that has calories, you digest. So will this affect his diabetes? Yeah, it depends on how much you drink. Yeah. You know, if he's drinking, you know, a bottle of rye whiskey a day, it's certainly going to affect his diabetes and his life. One drink or so.
He says occasionally.
Occasional, that's right. Yeah. I think an occasional drink is fine, but it doesn't matter what the alcohol is. Your body still digests it the same way.
I'm trying to get my head around rye whiskey and diet soda.
I know, it's just not something. I don't drink cocktails very much at all, but that doesn't sound like something.
You're going to have one occasionally. Have something good.
Yeah.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to uncork? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, toll free. And a listener now, Zorba in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Doctor.
You bet. How can we help?
Well, I had a question about suggestions for folks who are working on getting off of drugs or alcohol. After you get clean, you often feel really lousy for a long time, and I think that's why a lot of people relapse pretty quick, you know, just mentally, physically, emotionally. You know, it's pretty draining and difficult, and the days after you quit using. And I wanted to know if you had any ideas about other things that might be useful in helping that transition so that people will actually, you know, feel well enough to stay clean and not go back.
Yeah. Can you tell us about what kinds of things you've done or tried?
Yeah, well, I mean, over the last years, I mean, really anything I could get my hands on. Most recently, I got off heroin, was off that for a while, and now have just been drinking, not just, but... have been drinking and smoking pot, but don't really want to be because I don't, you know, I still feel lousy, obviously.
Oh, sure, sure. So let's look at it globally. What happens is when you're on any inebriant for any period of time, anything, doesn't make it as, you know, from alcohol, alcohol to pot to heroin to cocaine, you drain your body of endorphins. Now, endorphins are the natural chemicals in our brain that make us feel good. Natural chemicals in our brain. And what happens is when you stop using, you know, the initial phase when you stop using, you go through withdrawal. And that specifically is a rebound, you know, and that's a syndrome that may occur for a couple of days to a couple of weeks to a couple of months. But after that, the endorphins just don't normally work. So the way people are who haven't had a problem or haven't had a habit, things may make them feel good. But for the person who's a user, they haven't yet ramped up. There are a few things you can really do to make a difference. So first of all, regular exercise every day, 365 days a year. Now, when I mean exercise, it can be 10 minutes three times a day walking, you know, walking briskly so you feel like you're doing something. But it's some sort of exercise that makes you feel good. That's number one. Number two, a more Mediterranean diet. I think the Mediterranean diet is the healthiest diet in the world. It's a proven diet to reduce heart attacks and stroke. It's satisfying. It's delicious. It makes you feel better. If you don't know what it is, get a book, read about it, and try to follow it. Very, very useful. The next thing is meditation. Meditation can be very good. Now, there's the moving meditation of yoga, would combine stretching exercises in an environment with other people because it's often done in a class. It's really meditative, and there are yoga studios all over the country now. Anything to use your body when you're recovering is good. It's meditative, and it's something you may be able to do. So to get back a bit at your habit, what motivated you to quit?
Family. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, you know, you can't have a good family life,
mm-hmm. Right.
And be using. So.
Right, right. How long have you been dry?
It's been about a month and a half.
That's
now.
Good.
Well,
that's
from,
good.
From heroin, but mm-hmm. As I said, lately I've been drinking.
You've got to get the drinking under control. You know, going to AA can be helpful, but you want to get the drinking and pot under control. You can do it. It will take you, when you are totally dry of everything, it's a 2 to 6 month commitment before it's going to turn around your endorphins. So what you have to do, it's like a trip. Mm-hmm. You have to realize, if I'm going to go on a car trip to California from Wisconsin, it's going to be 40 hours to get to Los Angeles. That's how long it takes. Mm-hmm. And I've got to realize that when I get in the car. car, it's a long ride. You have a long ride ahead of you, but you can get there. It's that you have to have faith of your ability to hang on while you're doing it. Friends and family can support you to do that, and that can motivate you, and it sounds like you're motivated.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yeah. Before you go, do us a favor. In 6 months, give us a call and say, I did it.
I'd like to do that.
Promise me.
Yes.
Okay.
That'll be good. We'll
keep
track.
And thanks so much for the call.
Okay, thank you both.
Yep. 800-462-7413.
Such a difficult thing. So first of all, you've got a young guy. He has a family. He's had a habit. And when you stop, you don't necessarily feel good right away.
Yeah.
It's not that way. It takes a while to learn new habits, and it takes a while for your body to physically recover. So he's on the right road.
Yeah.
Let's hope that
happens.
Wouldn't
it be great to have that call in?
Yes, it would.
Mm-hmm. We'll be back next week. But before we head out today, Zorba, time to break out your robe and gavel for another episode of Judge Zorba.
Okay, I've got it. I've got my gavel right here. Okay.
Today's case comes to us from a listener named Ezra, who needs a debate settled with his doc. He writes, Dear Dr. Pastor, there's a debate going on between my family and my family doctor. My wife and I recently became parents. Ever since our son was born, my in-laws have been telling us that we should be putting a little bit of rice cereal in his bottle so he'll sleep through the night. From everything that we have heard and been told by our family doc, a baby should not have anything other than formula or breast milk until they are 6 months. To be honest, the only thing around here at this point getting its fill is my ears. So please, before my brain regurgitates all of this excess information, who is right?
Straight ahead, nothing but breast milk or formula for the first 6 months. Rice cereal is an old-fashioned, outmoded thing, and it does not get children to sleep through the night. Now, once again, my mother said the same thing to us, and when our children were young, we sometimes gave them rice cereal, but you know what? None of our kids slept through the night for the first 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
But no, breast milk, formula for the first 6 months, that's the way to go.
The judgment is in.
Judgment is in.
Time now to see Judge Zorba drop the gavel on that rice cereal killer. Have a debate you need settled? Add your case to the docket by sending it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
And we'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. And you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444, ask for program number 0726Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.